fixed, and he was on Larry King, and maybe that's even available. And so he became a big problem. And then a few months, 6 months later, they arrested the guy and kept him bottled up in jail for 8 years. Yeah. But,
oh, he was in that long. Hey, yeah, I keep forgetting that.
Yeah, he got put in 88.
He didn't just get put in, he got kept in.
It was in from early 89 till 94. The Clintons released him. He was in for 5 years.
On what grounds?
Oh, you hear Jim Keith. Brian just read Jim Keith's thing. He says, I don't know about LaRouche ripping off old ladies. You know, that's what he's accused of, mail fraud and taking, wills from old ladies.
No, they're Social Security checks.
But no, they actually got the money bequeathed to them, wills, supposedly. And these would be old ladies who had, who were from the 20s and 30s, who would see a real live politician, a literate guy, on TV talking what they understood politics was. They didn't understand anything after Carter. And they go, this is a real politician. They give them the money to him. They just suddenly get converted. And then the relatives would be pissed off, and the relatives would, sue and lead suits against them, and they just piled up. But he wasn't.
Brilliant.
I mean, maybe they were somebody. He was well infiltrated too. There were assholes in his organization.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And they might have been ripping people off, but he was just—he didn't even know about it. And once he got arrested, man, he even got up the ante. He had broadcasts while in jail. He could pay broadcasts, or his people did. He had definitely had a huge network, which was the Vatican, behind him. Because how do you pull this off? So here it is. 1984, and he's like Perot before Perot. Remember, Perot would get on in 92 and give lectures, have a half an hour, and have charts and show how we're in trouble? Yeah. This is what LaRouche is doing in the 80s, and he does three parts. And, okay, so this is 10 minutes. Let me just make sure all the sound is up, and we'll listen to what he says about the banking crisis. That's okay. So I think it's perfect. Okay, so I'm starting it. Actually, I'm stopping and going back. It gives the broadcast details. I want to see what the date is. It's just a little beep. Like at the beginning of videotape, it gives the...
spring of 84. Oh, wait, that. May 29th.
Yeah, it says the client, it says NEP Productions, client, Grand Design. Now, LaRouche is always on about the Grand Design, and McLuhan said the Grand Design got aborted by Simultaneous Electronic Man. So here's LaRouche carrying on the Gutenberg Manifesto of the Grand Design. And it says CBS, June 1st, length, CBS 6-1, whatever that means. Length is 27 minutes and 21 seconds. And the date is Mae Brussels' birthday, Carol, May 29th, 1984. So that fits. And I don't know what CBS 6-1, maybe that's the network, local something. But we would see them in Toronto. So here we go. And it says, the following political program has been paid for by the LaRouche campaign.
In a nationwide television broadcast on May 10th of this year, many of you heard presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche warning that the United States was on the verge of a new worldwide financial collapse, like that which occurred under President Hoover during the summer of 1931. He told you that it was impossible to predict the exact date of a world financial collapse. He warned that the collapse might begin next week, or might be postponed as long as into this fall, or, as a bare possibility, might not explode until early next year. The next day, May 11th, it was announced that the 8th largest bank of the United States, Continental Illinois, was at the edge of bankruptcy. Approximately a week after the Continental Illinois crisis began, the leading governments of Latin America announced the formation of a debtors' cartel. Then, on May 19th, the thing which Henry Kissinger and the U.S. Treasury Department said could never occur, did occur. the governments of Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, and Brazil formed a debtors' cartel against the ruinous looting policies of the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. Federal Reserve. The thing that Henry Kissinger and top officials of the State Department and Treasury Department promised never would happen.
We manifest our concern that the aspirations of our peoples to development and the economic security of our continent are seriously affected by foreign acts. We call for a meeting to the end of defining the most adequate initiatives and courses of action with a view to reach solutions satisfactory to all the nations involved.
That's a communique of the Ibero-American scientists. Let's see what it is.
Tonight, the
political statement by government. Let's go back. Yeah, it's a communique of the Ibero-American, which is LaRouche would call Latin America Ibero-America. Communique of Ibero-American presidents, May 19th, 1984. So there, now, as you're, if you're watching the video, they're showing newspaper articles as this guy is talking. I think it's Mel Konetsky. I recognize his face. Remember, I'm part of this group, all right? One part of me is in. I'm down there visiting them. I'm part of this. I'm probably funding them, but I'm not admitting it, right? So the thing is that you've got all this, you know, journalistic information is coming at you, and they're going to do this for half an hour, and this is a political campaign. He's educating the people. And I remember our foster son's girlfriend, Avril, when she watched one of these about 1990, she says, well, this is what a politician is supposed to do, right? This is actually a real politician. we'll carry on, but I'll stop it if I have to tell you. So just admit, there's all kinds of neat details are showing, newspaper headlines. And LaRouche comes on, says we're in big trouble, and then the next day the crisis starts. Now, what's interesting... Yeah. That's a crisis 30 years ago. We got homeopathic, even worse Armageddon's happening now. Like, this is nothing compared to the, say, 2000 or 2010, but this is 1984. You know, the frog water is boiling and people aren't noticing, but they're in trouble. And LaRouche is saying, no, we're in real fucking trouble now. And LaRouche has to live another 33 years. So is it? Yeah, 32 years. He's still saying and updating it. Yeah, you want to say something,
LaRouche,
Brian?
LaRouche is still enjoying the attempt to persuade others, Bob.
Yes, he's still trying to save us from nuclear war and collapse of the economy. Now everybody is just a porn star. They're just, you go on tour. How do so many people on all those porn channels be filming themselves fucking everything that moves? Millions of people. Who are these people? You know, they're all different. It just shows you the majority of the population has given up living a human-scale life. They don't even care about society. They're just fucking their brains out and broadcasting it, right? That's what's happened. And LaRouche predicted this. From LaRouche's point of view, this is not a healthy society. There's no science that's being made. And you're all going to die because you're not making any technology to keep the society going. All right, so now you got massive magnesium deficiency. What Carolyn's pointing out is everybody's too busy doing porn, not eating proper food, or even getting real magnesium. They're all dropping dead, like our rock stars.
Yeah.
So LaRouche, in broad terms, is predicting this. You know, broad Gutenberg galaxy, ideological, rational statements about people, we're going to get in trouble. Okay, so let's carry on.
Yeah, well, like, just why... Why the basic, why is it that our society is irrational? It's
right.
Not doing the things it's meant to do. It's not working for everybody's good ends. It's a complicated question, the how and the why.
Well, for 30 years, many baby boomers and younger have been figuring out how to survive knowing nobody's going to fix it. And they go into the New Age cult, so they go into, they all become life coaches. The population has been panicking for 30 years, trying to come up with ways of making money in a losing situation. Right?
Right. Yes. Right, and trying to figure out how to survive in a sort of a dropout way rather than a fix things collectively way.
Yeah, well, this is what Croker would go on about in the 80s, that social space is no longer there. The ground for a nation or for a community is gone. So everybody is an atomized dangling ganglia with five bodies trying to keep going.
Yeah.
It's kind of
all
like
right.
Beyond fatalism. Like,
right. Well, it becomes a meme in the 90s. We're in a post-Armageddon, post-apocalyptic world. That's what Generation Y grew up with, right? Generation X, and then Y. Y, they had, this is before the millennials, they had the meme that we're in a post-apocalyptic. They'd known it ended. You know that, Brian, right? That pop culture meme for people who are probably 40 now, maybe, or no, maybe 20, 30 or 5 or 40. The Mel Gibson
stuff. You even see it on like MTV, you know, in the 90s,
yeah.
There's a lot of like, you know, romanticized gas masks and every, you know, like the ashes are falling in slow motion in the music videos and everything like that.
Yes. Now, none of this makes sense unless you understand you get five bodies, because the chemical body has been abandoned, but people still have their typing chip body, and their TV bodies are still limping along, keeping them going. That's their food, you know, being informed, watching what they want to watch. There's that thing that keeps people going, and Ian says that most people are eating food that has no nutritional qualities at all in it. So Ian says this shows you don't need food to live. This is Ian's point. That don't think that you require what they say about nutrition. You don't, because you people are surviving on nothing for 20 years now. Right, Carol? Well, Carol can't go that far, but Carol summarizes it with magnesium deficiency.
Right, Carolyn? I know. It's just like that. Yeah. So don't make her sign off on that.
What, Carolyn, you got something to say, Carolyn?
Quadrant, that's a whole category in its own, Bob, that we're still trying to save the chemical body. Everybody's still trying to save the chemical body because we still have the illusion that it's necessary.
It's an archetype. They're saving an image. And we come along and we give you something that doesn't make any sense but works, and hopefully you stop hanging on those old images of what you think you need nutritionally or chemically or whatever level of chemical body image you think you have that you learned in med school. Your anatomy ain't
Carolyn,
what it used to be.
Carolyn, you were talking with Evan. And I was listening to the archive, and Bob, you were talking to, I don't remember what it was from, but maybe a private session, and she had asked you what the most interesting thing about the chemical body, you know, that you've come across, and the response was just how malleable it is, how you can, you know, those were nice words to kind of put to that perspective, is, you know, yes, we have a chemical body, but what we're doing with it, what it can do, you know, that's the part that can change and be adaptable or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think Ion every once in a while says it's a wonder we're all still alive because of the crazy things we do to our body, but it will come back. And, you know, I see that too with the Earth, where when we were in New York, they talk about the East River or this river or that river, totally polluted. You know, it'll take 200 years to get it back. And, you know, people would start doing little things, and within a couple of years, there were big changes. What happens
of improvement.
Of improvement. What happens with predictors, and it's like the Global 2000 people, the Club of Rome, all the things that LaRouche kind of brings up with the group that just wants us all to die, is they'll take a position and say, well, there's, and this is back, you know, 20, 30 years.
No, 40 years ago. This is 70s.
40 years ago. They'll say, well, there's 3 billion people. By the year, you know, 2020, there'll be 20 billion people, and we can't sustain that. And they won't allow that. Technology's going to advance. Everything's going to advance. You know, Bob's going to come along with Ion and everything. They don't take into consideration anything. They just...
Any positive input.
Any positive input. It's all, you know, die. And it's crazy. And that's what you see constantly in medicine, that, you know, this is where it is and where it's always going to be, and therefore we should restrict ourselves and act accordingly.
Right. And Carol's reading LaRouche's book, There Are No Limits to Growth, and where they lay a lot of that data out. And But LaRouche says the oligarchs have always been Malthusian, going back, you know, to the Black Death. They always say there's no hope. Your people are losers. We're glad most of you are going to die, and we're not. And don't plan on anything making this better.
I mean, they do die. This is what's so incredible. They're still caught up in all this, the drugs and the pollution and everything. They're dying
just like
everybody else. Years ago, the oligarchs, you know, there was this huge thing about fetal cell transplants. They'd go and get injections of either dead baby cells or dead lamb cells, and they thought that was going to save their lives. They try everything, but...
Well, that's why there's no Illuminati. They died off.
They died.
They didn't survive. There were drastic changes in the last 30 years.
Yeah, and, you know, when you look at the population now, what is it, 6-7 billion, and you think, well, their plan didn't work. They lost. So that's, you know, another reason why we should celebrate and just keep on doing what we're doing.
That's what Zappa said back in the 60s or 70s. He said, yeah, there's a lot of you beautiful people out there, but there's a lot more of us ugly people, and we're going to survive you people. So let's go back
to you two. Yeah. Right now, Carolyn is laying the ground for the chemical body that... You know, now it's a whole new...
She's even going to save Big Pharma. Big Pharma's going to be able to put their crap in you, and it won't affect you because
we've got
strong
genes.
You got the antidote.
Yeah.
So the drug companies will claim they're fixing everybody, but no, we're just allowing them to carry on and be irrelevant.
You're keeping the economy going. You're keeping,
keeping the big bullshit, the wad going.
You know, I remind people, don't stop your meds. Until your doctor decides that you shouldn't have them anymore. Not our fault.
Yeah, and Ian gives Carolyn particular details on particular drugs. He'll take this a particular drug, and he'll go into the chemistry of it, even talk about the hydrogen ions and what our stuff does to counter the effect of the particular drug. The chemistry knowledge
That's
is
great.
Incredible.
Yeah,
I agree. Listen to Jenny's questions with Ian. And he described.
You re-listen to what,
I re-listened to Jenny's questions with Ion. Wasn't last week. It was a few weeks ago. And Ion mentioned that it's very individual now. And there are there's a matter of the balance between Remite and Remag, where people can experience vertigo, moments of vertigo.
Yeah.
And I've had those, you know.
Yeah, me too.
But it does seem very individual as far as, you know, it felt like we were at a point where we're saturating and we're getting those minerals, but they are so powerful that they're still...
Right. I actually, Carolyn, the other day, you put out a new Remite bottle.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, at 3 in the morning, I took my Remite. Everything turned red. There was like a semi-psychedelic effect.
Oh.
I'd open my eyes and blink, and then everything would be red, and then it would fade away. But then I'd blink again, and it would become red, and then fade away. And I had to put up with this redness. I couldn't watch my TV for about an hour.
Wow.
So I figured it was the new Remite affecting me. I hardly ever get effects. But so so what were we just saying?
Individual.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the individual part. Is the Remite affected me that way? This weird red flash that was happening.
The shifting. Everybody shifts in a different way. And thankfully, the INETs know that a shift is likely a good thing.
Yeah, if that was actually happening to me, I would have called up Nelson's Hall. I said, did you fucking poison my acid box again? I mean, I'm dying. I'm on LSD. I'm not authorized.
I'm not paranoid anymore.
Yeah, don't want. You wondered what somebody gave you or what you took again. I'll never forget your line.
Yeah, I thought it was poison again.
How do I know?
I would have
a
thought
person
that.
Like me, know what I took in my life?
Yeah,
drugs.
That's right.
So, Lynette was in town.
Who? Oh, Loyette.
Loyette.
Did you say Lynette?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it had to be suspicious. Loyette and her gang out of Vancouver. I met these Ionettes this week. Who knows what you know they were doing with my stuff. Then she brought along her nieces, and that was tough having to deal with these 18-year-olds. Oh, my God. So I just fucking ranted at them constantly. And as I was saying goodbye to them, I said, it's wonderful to meet cynical teenagers once again. Lovely to meet cynical teenagers.
Wow.
Okay, so now, you know, I'm looking at this LaRouche 1984. You look up LaRouche 1984 banking crisis. There's all kinds of them. My whole collection is up there. You can watch the LaRouche day in and day out. Look at.
Are you going to
play this one way back in 1976 or something? No, they actually got a lot of them up. You can see all this LaRouche stuff, the presidential broadcast. So I'm going to continue this one. So they're explaining the collapse.
Tonight, the world and you, your family and your local community are sliding downward towards the depths of the worst depression in modern history. President Reagan's Herbert Hoover prosperity has come to a screeching halt. Yet, even after the first round of the new worldwide financial collapse has become headlines in the international press, top officials of the Treasury Department are still insisting that there must be no alteration of Henry Kissinger's monetary policies. On May 13th, Treasury Secretary Donald Reagan said,
"We're in the midst of a solid economic recovery. Our policies are now bringing the world results. The recovery overseas couldn't occur without our own economy turning up first. It has, and now others are recovering, and the process has accelerated."
On May 24th, another LaRouche hater in the Reagan administration, Treasury Deputy Secretary Tim McNamara, said about the South American debt crisis,
"My conversations with the fund indicate there is excellent progress down there."
And a May 25th UPI wire quoted Treasury Undersecretary Beryl Sprinkle, assuring everybody of an endless U.S. economic recovery.
"We believe there will be an upbeat economic summit in London. President Reagan will be reaffirming the kinds of sound policies being pursued in the U.S., and encouraging other leaders to pursue these elsewhere so that we can sustain the summit countries' current economic expansion."
There is perhaps only one man who has the expert knowledge and willpower to bring the United States and the world out of the present spiral of worldwide financial collapse. If you care about your family and your country, millions of you will act now to make that man the next president of the United States. He speaks to you now, Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche.
"Those foolish officials would try to say that there is no financial crisis, even after the collapse has begun, will try to tell you the Continental Illinois crisis is only an isolated individual case. It's true that certain powerful foreign financial interests did create a run against that bank. And it's also true there were special circumstances which made it possible to organize such a run on that bank at that moment. The fact is that most of the banks of the United States could be hit by the same kind of crisis at almost any time. The reason that it was possible to plunge Continental Illinois into that crisis is that the banking system as a whole is at the brink of collapse. To recognize what the Conti Illinois crisis means, look back at the newspaper headlines from the time President Hoover was still promising that prosperity is just around the corner. Look back for a moment to the newspaper stories of 53 years ago.
The Hoover administration was saying,
worst stock crash stemmed by banks. Leaders confer. Fine conditions sound. Stocks collapse, but rally at close cheers bankers. Bankers optimistic.
Then, in September 1931, the worldwide depression exploded into the headlines.
The Vienna Bank has collapsed.
Like the Conti Illinois crisis of these past weeks, the collapse of the giant Vienna Kreditanstalt Bank did not bring on the Great Depression of the 1930s all at once. Over the summer of 1931, foolish optimists, like those around Washington today, insisted that all will be well once a few technical adjustments took effect. The world waded through a crescendo of local financial crises throughout the summer of 1931. Then, in September of that year, the British pound collapsed. the Great Depression, Adolf Hitler, and World War II became the worldwide realities set into motion by the foolish governments and big financial houses of Washington, New York, and London. The only important difference between the Great Depression of the 1930s and the new worldwide depression erupting today, it is unless we act now to stop this new depression, it will be far, far worse than any of you old enough to remember from the 1930s could remember. This depression can be stopped, and stopped right now, but only by a U.S. president strong enough to force savage reforms on both the Federal Reserve System and the International Monetary Fund, as well as on that silly bureaucracy over at the State and Treasury Departments. I could stop this depression right now if I were your president. I could stop this depression right now if President Reagan would allow me to guide his hands through this deadly crisis. I am personally fully aware of my personal limitations. But with all those limitations, there is no other presidential candidate who has the knowledge and intellectual toughness to lead our nation and the world out of the New World Depression, which began to erupt with the crisis of Conti, Illinois, on this May 11th. History has repeated itself. The same stupid mistakes made by the administrations of President Calvin Coolidge and President Herbert Hoover have been repeated by the administrations of Carter Mondale and President Reagan. The policies which have led us into this new worldwide depression spiral this past month are very nearly exact copies of the policies of the Coolidge and Hoover administrations. The policies of Paul Volcker and Donald Reagan, which have sent us plunging into a new worldwide financial collapse, are copies of the stupid policies of Hoover's Secretary of the Treasury, Mellon. Not only have the Carter, Mondale, and Reagan administrations learned nothing from the way in which Coolidge and Hoover brought on the Great Depression of the 1930s, the leading circles in Washington and the international banking community have listened to and have rejected repeatedly my forewarnings of exactly what has happened during the month of May. As many of you know, I'm the designer of the LaRouche-Riemann quarterly economic forecast for the United States. Over the period from November 1979 through the end of 1983, this published forecast has been consistently the most accurate forecast published anywhere in the world. During the same period, the published forecasts of the U.S. government have been consistently absurd, and other published forecasts of private forecasting agencies correct only for a few isolated quarters. In other words, these governmental and financial circles have been continuing a policy leading directly to the disaster which erupted this May, although they knew that the world's most accurate forecasting service had warned repeatedly that this new financial collapse would occur during the first half of the 1980s unless present Federal Reserve and IMF policies were drastically reformed.
So that's the end of part one, and then you get to see the follow-ups. Now, what LaRouche, let me see if everybody here, all things are opening up here. What LaRouche didn't know, this is May 29th, May Brussels would have been 62. She'd live another 4 years. What they didn't know, what LaRouche didn't know, even though I was helping his organization, is that Bob Marshall was meeting with the executive of CKLN to start his broadcast, which would start on the last week of August 1984. And hope for humanity and the downward spiral of the last 20,000 years would start to move more positive in its direction because of Bob Marshall's moves toward the air. So that was the hidden ground in that year, me and Bobby. Moving toward the electronic space to begin even better broadcasts than LaRouche did. Are you with me, people?
Cool.
I am. Themes have you found in your life?
What, Gene?
One by.
Only one, Bob Dobbs. That's my name. Remember, I'm not Bob Marshall. Bob Marshall used the name Bob Marshall,
no,
and his
I
real
know.
Name was Ed Pusar.
I know, but you didn't use different
names. Bob.
Different person.
Oh, whoa, I do Bob Nevert here. Yes, when I went to James in 2008, I to save him from the ignominy of my real name and all the shit that would come at him, I said, okay, I'll take this name off my chart, and it's in the Thompson Quadrant. Bob Nevert, who is actually a relative of mine over in Paris, who was in, the accountant for the oligarch we worked for. So Bob Nevert it. Even though it sounds like a put-on name, it's actually his name, Bob Nevert.
Nevert it. But so you never used names that you haven't shared that we don't know about?
As far as I know. Now, when Mike and I stopped doing CKLN in 91, he left in February. His last show was February 20th. There's a 2-2, February 20th, 1991. And then I was supposed to be on International Women's Day March 8th, but the Lesbian Caucus called me up and said, fuck you, Bob. You don't have anybody supporting you. You're gone. We don't need you around. But they didn't know. Basically, that's what's her name did. What was her name? Yeah, see, now I'm free in the 21st century to smear the reputations of all these people. They'll all go down in history as Nuremberg dupes, you know, because I get the last word. What was her name? Denise Carroll. What was her last name? Denise something. She was a columnist. If Neufeld was here, he'd know the name. Denise. Yeah. But but they didn't know I had a bunch of supporters. So on the first week in August, I went on Wayne Morris's show. And I played, and I was on April, May, June, July, August. I did five more two-hour shows, and I played a lot of evergreens. And managed to complete my stay at CKLN in the way I wanted it. So Denise and them, they didn't like that, but they couldn't stop me. So now, what was I going to say about this? So this is in 91.
What were we talking about? Doing to save the world, because LaRouche.
What was it? 91.
We went into CKLN.
We finished.
While LaRouche was talking about the world collapsing. You were already saving it.
No, that's 1984. This is 1991. I finished my thing at CKLN. And, about names, that's right. So Mike Dyer left on February 20th, and I stayed till August. You look on the timeline to see what date, probably the first week in August. So then in September 91, Jerry Fialka is visiting me. He was working with us for Zappa, and he started coming up every year. He loved hanging out with us. And Mike Dyer called up and said, I live out in the country, but I'm going to drive in to CKLN, and I'm going, that's why he quit. He had to move to the country. So he said, I'm driving in. I have to fill in for so-and-so. So Mike wasn't going to get a show back. He just was going to fill in that week. And he wanted me to come on with him. So I said, well, Jerry's here. So he went on. So because I basically was not welcome at the station anymore because I'd left, I decided to use a different name. So I used the name Bob Nevert. You know, 17 years before James, I had my armament, my ammunition. Matter of fact, let's see if we can play a little bit of the beginning of that. So Jerry and I go on, and Mike Dyer is dealing with Bob Nevert, and everybody knows who I am, but we lie. That's what you do when you're in journalism. You lie to the people. You must adapt, adopt, and survive. So if we go down to 1991, September something. September 6th. Yeah, it says Bob Nevert and Jerry Fialka join Mike Dyer, who substitutes for another host show on CKLN. So let's see what this sounds like.
That's where we started off on live at 11 o'clock. As I mentioned last week, I'm having to give up my show for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it's just that I'm moving out of the city, and I'm moving well out of the city, like too far out of the city to come in every Friday to do a show. So I've got two shows left, and then I'm gone for a while until such a time as something changes or I come into Toronto more regularly. But my ultimate goal is to cut myself off from the city as much as possible in the future. And so nothing personal, just time to move on. So we've got two shows left this week, today, Friday, and next Friday, and then that'll be it. And then somebody else will be coming in. I suspect it will be Bruce Tisdale, all going well. But just to announce, we have some guests coming down next week to celebrate that, and also some special guests this week. For a long time, I was hosting a show on Wednesdays at midnight with J.R. Bob Dobbs, and I had to leave that show. J.R. wanted to do other things with Wayne Morris, and once a month. Well, J.R. is still around. I don't know where he is exactly. I know I hear from him periodically. He leaves messages on my machine, but somebody is coming down, a gentleman by the name of Bob Neverett. Now, Bob is J.R. Bob Dobbs' accountant. So there's a little unfinished business to take care of. Bob Neverett will be coming down to do that. We also have another guest who is somehow associated or related to, although I'm not sure how, Bob Neverett. I know he's a subgenii. I know he follows J.R. Bob's words. He's also a McLuhanite, and he lives far, far away from Venice, California. Pixel poophead artist Jerry Fialka will be down as well to talk, and we'll play a little music and just rant for about an hour. They should be here in about 50 minutes. Time to move on. A little more music. I have a little bit of business to take care of, and then we're going to play a cassette by Ron McFarlane. And the number here, if you have any questions or inquiries, is 595-1655.
Okay, so I'm going to move it forward, see... we can hear how we present ourselves.
I never realized that Mike was such a bad mic breather. He's breathing into the microphone. Worst thing you can do.
Well, I think people liked it. They found it sexy, Carol. Mike was a very popular DJ, very popular programmer. He was. I think
he's got a great voice, but... Yeah.
What? Let's
intimate.
It's very intimate.
He's breathing.
Remember,
if
you look in McLuhan's book, Laws of Me, he's breathing down your central nervous system. He's inside you, not in your body. That's external. But you read Laws of Media and McLuhan's tetrad on the radio. The radio creates a silent private bubble. That's the immediate effect of the environment, original radio.
Yeah.
And so Mike communicated to the little Bible, and then I was like your conscience or the devil in the dental hygiene dilemma section of 200 Motels, Zappa's movie, where Jeff wants to leave the band. He's got the angel yakking at him and the devil, and they're arguing over whether Jeff should leave the band or not and go do blues. Well, I have an intimacy of that. When I'm on there with Mike, Mike's, you know, chemical body energy, but I'm your fucking inner soul, inner self saying this and that. I'm whispering to you. You listen to me. I'm so very intimate. I'm astral intimate in my voice. All right, Carol? Okay, you get that, Carol?
Got it, Bob.
Let's see if it happens.
You don't mouth breathe into the mic.
No. I don't have a mouth. I'm an astral entity.
Explain the
dog
frequencies.
Right, the dog whistle. I'm a dog whistle.
The whole
world, nobody notices it. But so Jerry, I'm interested in what me and Jerry, so here's Jerry. So he calls, Mike calls Jerry a pixel poophead. Did you catch that? See, Jerry was one of the first to start pixel video with that little children's toy. And he started a pixel festival. Yeah,
wow.
You know the pixel toy?
Light bright?
I don't know.
Put up with some company.
Yeah, maybe that was it. These little toy video cameras for kids. Yeah. And
Okay, I know what you mean. I don't know the name, but
yeah, PXL. They were called. He called it Pixel. And so maybe that was the technique. The technology was Pixel. And so he started showing in little stores and places that he could get space in 1991. Oh yeah, when I showed up in 1990, he pixeled me. That's what he did. He came to Toronto. Remember, Carol? We did it on the balcony. He pixeled with his little new camera that he'd found somewhere because Jerry was a dumpster diver. He didn't have any money, so he's always just going with whatever he could find. So he finds his little toy camera that someone threw out. Their kid didn't want it. And he comes to Toronto in 89, and he films me. We probably can even find them on Google.
Fisher Price,
right.
Yeah.
And they he interviewed me on with his stupid interviewing technique, but it's cute what I say. I deal with the issues, get around his stupidity, and then he wanted to show these to people, so he invented the idea of a pixel festival just to show pixels of me. And it took off. People came to it. That's in Venice, California. And so then other artists and that started sending their pixels. There turned out to be a lot of people that were doing this. A lot of artists were using the Pixel or Star Tour, got the idea from Jerry. And one of them, Brian, was Tentatively Inconvenient. You might remember that sub-genius guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was, yep. He did that, something like that, and he became a friend of Jerry's. And this is in 90, 91, before the album came out, before I was banned from the sub-genius world. So he and Tentatively Convenient were friends until the scandal happened. Then Jerry, I don't think, ever talked to the guy again. He wouldn't talk to Jerry. Stang told him, get the back off. You cannot talk to
right,
Bob's
yeah,
minions. You can't talk to Jerry.
Yeah, the Bob, the close Bob allies are all blacklisted.
Yeah, they're all blacklisted by the, but Tentatively Convenient, I don't know what he ever did, but Jerry goes on and did like 20 of them. Maybe he still does it. He got a bit of a reputation in Venice and in the art world for doing the Pixel Festival. So, old Mike Dyer, who's passive aggressive, always was passive aggressive, always takes swipes at me or any of my friends. He just says, this guy, we don't know who he is, apparently. Now, he was calling me J.R. Bob Dawes. I never claimed I was J.R. Bob Dawes, but Michael insisted on it, so I never argued with it. But Stang and them could say, look, you're claiming you're J.R. Bob Dawes. I didn't say that. Mike said it. But I wasn't going to argue every time he said it, you know, cause a fuck. So I just tolerated it. And so he did it. He said, J.R. Bob Dawes got this associate, and he's a Pixel poop head. That's what he said.
there's a Pixel... You guys, there's a Pixel 2000 camcorder on eBay for $49.95.
Okay.
Good.
All right.
Fun.
So let's
you
see.
Started selfies.
I don't know.
Started selfies too.
Right. Right.
Or MTV
so,
music videos.
So I'm moving this thing forward. I don't know. It looks edited. So let's just see. Maybe he doesn't play.
But I don't know where he is exactly.
Oh, okay. Let's just. I think we heard that,
I know,
right?
I know.
Where, where Bob is.
I actually meant because Dobbs.
Oh, there I am.
Time to move on. A little more music.
All right. So, Gene, this is Bob Dobbs pretending to be someone else. I don't bother to change my voice. I do nothing. I just have a different name, okay? So you hear me talking about Bob Dobbs, apparently. What?
Yeah. A little bit of business to take care of, and then we're going to play a cassette by Ron McFarlane. And then I'll be here if you have any questions or inquiries. It's 595-1655.
CKLN is proud to host...
We also heard Dusty Collects, Ron McFarlane from... And I have some guests coming down. They are Bob Nevert, who is the accountant for J.R. Bob Dobbs. As I mentioned earlier, this is my second last show. Next week is my last program. And so J.R. Bob Dobbs has a little bit of business to clear up. And so he won't come down, but on behalf of J.R. Bob Dobbs and the Church of the Subgenius, we have Bob Nevert, Bob's accountant. Also, a friend and an acquaintance, Jerry Fialka, who is from Venice, California, who works with the Pixel camera and has produced a number of interesting videotapes. Will be coming down to talk not only about the Pixel phenomena, but also about Bob and about Zappa and about whatever else might be on his mind. So that'll probably round up the last 50 minutes or so. 595-1655, two pairs of tickets to join the air. And
yay.
And here they are. Welcome to Bob Nevert and Jerry Fialka. Jerry, as I mentioned, from Venice. And Bob Nevert, are you Toronto-based?
No, Mike.
Where are you from?
Last I recall is Paris.
Paris.
That's about 6 years ago.
Okay.
Nice to meet you, Mike.
You are J.R. Bob Dobbs' accountant, is that
yes.
right? So we decided just because of time, we're going to have to put the two of you together. The two of you have never met, and we'll bring you together as one interview. Is that okay?
Oh, that's fine.
We've only got about 35 minutes, so...
We have met.
We have met.
We have actually met because Dobbs hired me to make a documentary on him this past week. I've been able to spend 5 days with him shooting 14 hours of footage, which included him wiping up his kitchen floor with a massive amount of toilet paper.
Mm-hmm. We all know about J.R. Bob Dobbs' cleanliness, and that's an important
thing.
He's been all this fetish.
And Jerry here had to, Mr. Fialka here had to go through me in setting up the documentary, and that's how we met.
Sure. We're sort of on a business brunch. yeah, at the moment.
Right now. So, well, thank you for coming in then. Jerry, you have used this technology, which is old and new at the same time. That's the Pixel Cam. And perhaps for those who don't know or aren't familiar with the Pixel technology and the camera and how it works, you could give a brief description of the technology.
This is a toy video camera that actually J.R. Bob Dobbs invented some 22 years ago, but it just became popular in this last 5 years. And then about 2 years ago, they discontinued it. He allowed Fisher-Price, the toy company in America, to put it out. And the box that you receive your Pixel camera in has a picture of J.R. Bob Dobbs as a child with his hair moosed up making his home rock video. But since most kids nowadays want top quality in this electronic, what is it, visual bias,
addiction,
the whole bit, all those words that Bob always uses, acoustic space,
hoiked up, that's one of my favorites.
It's madness for me as an accountant. I mean,
I can understand.
He cooks his books in those terms.
So anyways, this camera became popular with the artsy fartsy crowd, and since it only costs $100 and you can actually shoot the audio and the visual portion on an audio cassette, it's cheap, and that's all Bob could afford to make this documentary. And I'm actually going to have a festival of Pixel film and videos in LA in the fall, and since I'm running the festival, we'll only be showing my Pixels.
You've also brought in some music, and let's just keep this wide open. I mean, we'll go in any direction you'd like to go. If you'd like to play one of the tapes, we can. If you'd like to talk further about the accounting, we could. If you'd like to talk more about what's going on in Venice, we could. So
right. Mike, you worked with J.R. Bob Dobbs
for 4 years.
4 years. Yeah. How did this affect your life?
Oh, it changed it drastically. I mean, I'm now moving out of the city. I still, I don't have a job, which is good, and yet I've been able to buy a house, in fact, out in the country, and we know what the word is. The word is slack. And even though we're not doing the show anymore, I've retained more knowledge and more slack in 4 years' time. The evolution was a gradual one. It didn't happen overnight. I was skeptical at first, but I'm a totally changed person as a result.
Do you think this move to the country is your way of accomplishing media fast?
Oh, definitely. We'll be isolated in the country. We won't have a television. We may have a radio from time to time. We may buy the odd paper just to find out what the weather's going to be like. But otherwise, this is definitely all part of the Media Fast 92, which goes into full effect in a couple of months.
Yeah. But you will be creating?
Well, yeah, I will be creating. So it's not to be confused with the art strike, which I'm not a part of. The art strike and the Media Fast, I think, are two different things. So I'll still be creating.
But do you live to create or create to live?
Oh, both. Both.
How about you? What's your name again?
Bob Neverett.
Oh.
I just live to cook the books for Bob Dobbs.
Cook them?
Totally visually biased.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have an example of the way Bob has to coordinate the Secret Council 10 and the Holy Offices, and I'm constantly dealing with the tetrads of each Holy Office. For example, in the Holy Office of, let's say, astronomy,
mm-hmm.
I have to deal with the fact that astronomy, by its very nature, enhances Dr. Peter Beter.
Ah.
All right. It extends Peter Beter and at the same time obsolesces Mae Brussel, but retrieves cosmic awareness. And when you push Peter Beter to extreme, you get Garrett Dean. So that's an example of this chart here I brought in to show you how the books are moved around. And all these holy offices represent huge stores of gold, wealth of the human race, and you have to relate them as Bob moves into various countries, various governments, various corporations. As he deals with them, he has to sort of show one of the holy offices rather than another one, and then he has to show how the relationships between them move around. And that's an example.
Maybe you could talk about the geometry, since I'm basing this Pixel documentary on J.R. Bob Dobbs, on James Joyce's book, Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Well, the way we have four books. That's what the tetrads. We have most corporate accountants use double entry,
uh-huh.
but I use quadruple entry.
That sounds like a sexual act.
Yes. Well, working with Bob, anything you do involved with him, it creates incredible hard-on problems, you know.
There's a little drool coming out of the side of your mouth.
Yes, yes. Just thinking of the paperwork that I do with Bob. I mean, Bob and
Was Moon good, that good last night?
Moon? Not as good as Weasel. It was his birthday. He was 22 years old yesterday.
22.
Yeah, it was his present.
So this is number 7, so 7 plus 7 is 14.
What 7? This Holy Office?
Yeah, this Holy Office.
Yeah, where's the other 7?
Well, I'm just saying, you double it.
No, you quadruple it. The 4 oh. 7s are 28.
Okay.
So I'll just 214. No, that's 214.
That's why you're the accountant and I'm the filmmaker.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to do this. But taking the Holy Office of Geometry.
You got any spare change?
Yeah, right here. Just put the nickel in to keep this electricity going. All right. The Holy Office of Finnegan's Wake and James Joyce, when you enhance Finnegan's Wake, you obsolesce Peter Beter.
Mm-hmm.
And you
What's obsolesce mean?
Means you put him to a side. That particular Holy Office appears very anemic and not very relevant to the percept you're trying to create when you're doing the presenting the books to us to show a good profit balance, you know.
Okay.
And so Beter is obsolete when you enhance Finnegan's Wake, and then you retrieve Marshall McLuhan.
Who's he?
He's a guy who lives here in Toronto, and he was suppressed because he knew Wyndham Lewis's stuff too much. He understood Wyndham Lewis too deeply.
Apes of Man?
Apes of God. That was suppressed by the Bloomsbury Group, you know, Virginia Woolf and Clive Bell and those people.
Why would they suppress it?
Because he exposed them. He showed how they're agents of the Gnostic and Masonic matter-spirit split.
What's wrong with that?
It's bad accounting.
Okay. Ah.
So when you retrieve Marshall McLuhan, when you're enhancing the Office of Geometry, you then push Finnegan's Wake into its opposite, which is Cosmic Awareness. You see, Finnegan's Wake is anti-trance, and Cosmic Awareness is channeled through people in trance.
Mm.
So you go from non-trance into trance. And you see, these are icons that are manipulated in relation to Secret Council 10 subsidiaries who know the value of each icon, and therefore, I'm just giving you the surface label for vast stores of wealth that the members of the Secret Council subsidiaries understand. You know what I mean? I mean, this represents a vast computer network of statistics, figures, graphs, curves.
You've seemed to learn this very well. How long have you worked with Bob Dobbs?
Well, I met him as a boy in the 30s. A couple people in the old
business. So you used to chum around, or?
Well, I was sort of a babysitter in the early 30s. Well, Bob was born 1922, so around 1932, when we were putting Hitler into power, the oil people, I was working for them, and it was like with Krishnamurti, when Annie Besant of the Order of the Golden Dawn, the Theosophists, thought that Krishnamurti was the new Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the corporate guys, they picked up, the Theosophists picked up Krishnamurti as a child and decided he was the new Messiah in the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the corporate boys knew that the new Messiah in the corporate world for Tetrarch Management was this young person born on February 2nd, 1922, the day Ulysses came out by James Joyce. And that was Bob Dobbs, he was put under my charge in the early years because he had to learn this kind of obscure mathematics really early, and that was just one of the things he learned.
And so you've been with him many years.
Yeah, what is it? I'll be 60 years in next year.
Ah, so besides being his accountant, have you actually instructed him on some of this knowledge, or
yeah,
did he instruct you?
Well, that was interesting. Yeah, when I taught him this basic cooking the book stuff in the 30s, you know, in his teens. He was subject to trance often. He would channel a lot of information from the Axis on how to manipulate our accounting better. And yeah, we would tap into Bob's potential, and he would help us along in the courses. It was a dialogue. That's the slackfulness of relating to Bob as a babysitter, as a chartered accountant. This is a constant exchange of new energy and new input. I mean, Bob, it was a genius as a kid. He then became a sub-genius.
What's his relationship with the Booties, and what's your relationship with them?
I don't have access to the Booties. When Bob took over the Secret Council 10 in February 2nd, 1988, he kind of pushed a lot of us butlers and aides to him to the side because he didn't need our work anymore. And that's why the Mafia was busted. in the early 80s.
But did he do this in a copacetic pattern?
Oh, yeah, he said it. He gave us much slack. And I don't have time. It's like a Howard Hughes situation. I don't see Bob much. And, you know, I wasn't with you when you were taping Bob over the past week, but I was there at the front to arrange the meetings with him and give him time.
You were bringing in the extra rolls of toilet paper. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, and so I don't have much access to Bob because he's very busy.
Does he give you turkeys on Thanksgiving and Christmas Day?
No, just gives us some tofu.
Tofu.
Yeah.
So anyways, your relationship with the Booty's none.
I have no, I've heard the tapes, you know, I have a very good archives of Bob's work going way back, which will be very valuable for me personally later when I get fired by Bob. You know, at a certain point he has to fire everybody because electric autonomy is the fate of every person on the planet. And so at the point of Bob Rule lockdown, we're going to be knocked off. So I've been laundering away a lot of archives, which will get me through my post-100-year-old age phase.
Are you trying to tell me your Bob archives are bigger than mine?
The pre-Bob subgenius archives, when Bob was a genius, which will be very interesting to archaeologists. You know what I mean? You have a good subgenius. Bob is subgenius. Okay. But I have Bob as genius, which admittedly, for the subgeniuses isn't that valuable, but for the pinks, they'll really want to understand the origins. They want to track Bob's psyche and figure out how he got this way, and they'll be interested in the early stuff like psychologists. So they'll be interested in my stuff. I don't think many subgeniuses would buy my stuff, but most subgeniuses don't have any money, so I'm interested in selling to the pinks.
Right, so you're figuring you can cash in major on this and...
Oh yeah, when I go and when Bob cuts me and my family out, that's what's going to happen. Because when the electric implosion happens and Bob locks down the mimetic process of the Antichrist, then he's going to get very paranoid and he will be quite impersonal with most of us. But this is all understood. I mean, that was part of the bargain. And when we joined the church,
mm-hmm.
So we're on our own at a certain point.
Yeah. How many people in your family?
My personal family?
Yeah.
It was only three. It was my wife and I and one child.
Yeah, and are they allowed to ever touch or meet Bob?
Not since 88. Well, it was a great family before 88, but once Bob locked down and had to deal with the Exodus, it was such a crisis for the fate of the planet that Bob hasn't had time to deal with anybody. He's basically a computer image for us.
And have you raised your child a particular religion?
No, Bob never imposed religion to subgeniuses. I myself am Catholic, so I raised Bob my child as a Catholic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We don't think religion's that important, so we don't care what people do, how they bring up their kids. That's anthropomorphic content. And we just basically try to train the kids in sensory perception, sensory training, so they can deal with the vast changes coming and the vast stability that'll be locked down with Bob. That'll be very upsetting after a period of incredible changes. Then well, how do you deal with the iconic thrust of stasis? You know what I mean? It'll seem like a paralysis to most people. It'll be like a cold turkey. So we just pretend we're teaching kids stuff while we offer them real hidden stuff behind the scenes.
I see. And what is your son or daughter?
I said son, didn't I?
Oh, yeah, okay. Son. And what's his name?
His name is,
Mike? Do you know him?
No, I haven't seen him. I mean, he was born.
It doesn't matter what his name is. Have you ever taken him putt-putt golf?
Taken him out in golf?
Yeah, golf. Miniature golf.
No, I've never done that.
Well, why not?
I haven't had time, you know.
Come on, give it up, dude.
Look, I was locked away by the early 50s. I mean, I don't know when these putt-putts things
started. That means a lot.
I was working with Bob since the early 50s, like any corporate executive, you know, on the solar government level.
You want
to start outside? I really didn't have much access to people. What, you want to start a fight?
It's time for some music.
Yeah, anyways, my son, I haven't seen him in a couple of years, so I think what... Jeez, Mike, you don't know. I don't know you. I think it's Ferdinand or something.
Ferdy.
Not Fergie, Ferdy. Okay, bye-bye, Ferdy. Bye-bye, Ferdy. That's a great musical. Remember that one?
Oh, I love it.
And Margaret. Okay, Mike. Mike.
Okay, can I come back in?
Yeah. Mike, come on back in.
Thank you.
We're drowning.
It's okay. Jerry, you brought some stuff. We've only got 20 minutes. Let's play something.
Okay, so, the first track is... that short little...